We are talking once again with Joff Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
No Maria again this week. We're hoping she'll be back next week. She's swamped with work again.
Yes, and we will we'll be going over the general election ballot later in the show, so that will give her a chance next week to chip in on her her perspective on some of these races.
Yes. So I'm sure there'll be plenty of agreement between you two, and I always enjoy hearing when you have differing opinions.
Yeah.
All right. So, but before that, we got a couple local stories to touch on, starting out with the city of Seattle having a settlement.
Yeah, and I'm going to butcher this gentleman's name, but the city settled a lawsuit by the family of Iosia Falatogo. He was a man who was killed on New Year's Eve of 2019 in North Seattle by Seattle Police Department. He was not armed at the time of his shooting. He had dropped a handgun in an earlier struggle. And according to body cams, his last words were, "Nope, not reaching." That didn't get a whole lot of media attention at the time, but the OPA ruled that the shooting was somehow justified, even though the man was unarmed at the time of his death. But the family sued, and the city of Seattle settled for some $500,000, $515,000 this week. And it would be really excuse me, it would be very interesting to see an accounting of just how much SPD costs the city each year in lawsuits. It's difficult to calculate because, of course, the city has insurance to cover such things. But, you know, you especially in the wake of last summer's protests and the number of lawsuits wending their way through the courts regarding SPD's abuses in its handling of those protests, it would be very interesting to see an accounting of just how much in increased insurance rates and out-of-pocket expenses that taxpayers are coughing up, you know, how much SPD is costing the city each year for its abusive force and use of deadly force when it's not justified. This particular case, as I said, didn't get a whole lot of attention at the time. It was a holiday, so the local media was all, off vacating. This unfortunately has been a pattern with SPD over the years where, the alleged oversight bodies for SPD, rule that it's justified because they don't have a subpoena power. So all they can do is review the investigation of the department itself. And then the family winds up suing and the city winds up settling because it's cheaper to settle than it is to take the lawsuit all the way through the courts with no guarantee that you would win because, you know, a jury can look at that or a judge can look at that and say, no, this was not following SPD protocol. It was not congruent with SPD's use of deadly force guidelines. And the family has a point here. In this case, Falatogo had two young children that will be the primary beneficiaries along with the lawyers of the settlement. But once again, it will be very interesting to see just how much SPD is costing the city each year in these settlements because it seems to be a recurring pattern with these lawsuits that they wind up getting settled for large sums of money. And the judge is not very happy with SPD's behavior in these incidents.
Well, and it also contributes to the consent decree that has been in place since 2012.
Yes. How's that reform process coming along? I don't think it's it would be interesting to see if the supposedly reformed SPD is having fewer of these lawsuits. Anecdotally, I don't think it is, but I haven't been, I admittedly haven't been keeping a firm tally. So, somebody somewhere should be. It's easy for me to say because I'm not doing it, but, you know, it would be good to see that kind of accounting. And the city, of course, prefers to bury it in, you know, insurance premiums and other things that make it very difficult to calculate. Because if taxpayers had an idea of how much SPD was costing them each year, not just in the normal operating budget, but also in the wrongful death suits, I think people would be a little bit up in arms.
Yeah. Well, one of the, and we've mentioned this before, but one of the entities that is pushing for transparency of the oversight groups, of the three oversight groups, and doing a great job is Carolyn Bick at the South Seattle Emerald, who continues even this week to just coming out with damning information on the different oversight entities that...
Yeah, and if anybody's not following her on Twitter or online at the South Seattle Emerald site, please do so, because she's really one of the best public safety reporters in Seattle right now.
Mm-hmm. All right. So moving on there, we have we're going to be talking about the ballot in just a sec, but they're still squeezing in plenty of debates. And
yeah, there was a very high profile televised debate between the two remaining mayoral candidates, Lorena Gonzalez and Bruce Harrell, this week. And I don't know anybody else, but I found it virtually unwatchable. And there was nothing surprising about it. Both candidates were true to form. Lorena Gonzalez came off as something of a technocrat. She has very detailed plans for a lot of different challenges that the city is facing. And Bruce Harrell seems to sort of randomly string buzzwords together. I can't exactly tell what his plan is, except that it's data-driven. For sure it's data-driven. And except for homelessness, because the data over the last 20 years would suggest that the whack-a-mole policies that the city has been pursuing don't work. But he wants to continue them and double down on them, actually. But other than that, and deferring to the business community wherever possible, it's not really clear what his priorities would be at mayor. He does come off very much as something of a narcissist. He has a very high opinion of himself, certainly. And this was one of the complaints of his constituents in South Seattle when he was on city council, was that he really, his office really wasn't approachable, really not responsive. If you look at where his contributions are coming from, they're primarily from downtown interests, from the business community. They're not from his old district. And he didn't run for re-election 2 years ago on city council specifically because he knew he was going to lose to Tammy Morales, who nearly beat him in 2015 and would have beaten him in 2019. And, of course, she was elected to city council anyway in 2019 without him in the race. The mayoral race has Harrell and in Harrell and Gonzalez, the two most recent city council presidents. Harrell was president before he left council, and then Gonzalez was elected to that position in 2019. And just in their record as council president, the contrast in the temperament between the two of them couldn't be clearer, because Harrell was really very autocratic and very random. He would threaten to clear the council room of public spectators and public commenters if they were too noisy or too disruptive in his view. Whereas Gonzalez has been much more accommodating. And I think that's a reflection of how they look at democracy. And honestly, we've had that for the last 4 years with Jenny Durkan. It would be hard to imagine that being a more constructive approach under Harrell. I don't think it would be. Again, Gonzalez lays out very clear plans for how she would deal with homelessness, how she would deal with zoning, how she would deal with SPD and with crime, public safety. She has plans for all these things. And that came through very clearly in the debate. I would encourage people to go find it. It's on Seattle Channel in their archives.
Hmm. All right. Well, that takes us to a regular segment that we do both before the elections and then wrap up afterwards, but analysis of who you see as the strongest candidates in different positions.
Yeah, or at least describing what their stances are and what your priorities as listeners to this show might be. The ballots are in the mail. If you haven't gotten it already, you probably will today. Assuming that the sorting machines haven't all been destroyed at this point.
Louis DeJoy, shredding centers.
Exactly. I would encourage people for that reason to use the drop boxes. They are, generously located throughout King County. King County Elections has a whole list of them. And that's simply a more secure way to get your ballot delivered than the U.S. Postal Service at this point. Either way, either in drop boxes or through the mail, your ballots are due by Tuesday, November 2nd. So you've got about 2.5 weeks to worry over this election. And there are some, particularly in the higher profile races, some very, very clear choices. But there are also a number of less high profile offices that are up for re-election or up for election. And so I want to go through some of those as well. And we'll just take them in the order that they appear on the ballot, starting with the King County positions. King County Executive Dow Constantine is running for another term as county executive. He's served 3 terms already, I believe. And he's being challenged by State Senator Joe Wynn from West Seattle, who was just elected as a state senator a couple of years ago, has done a really good job in Olympia. He's challenging Constantine from the left, as opposed to Constantine's usual challengers in the past have been from the business community. In this case, Wynn is challenging him from a more progressive platform. And he's saying, you know, look, the county has all of these issues with things like, you know, the youth jail, safe injection sites, things like this that are just taking a very, very long time under Constantine to get resolved. And he wants to prioritize these things. He wants to prioritize the immigrant community, which now makes a pretty big share of the population of unincorporated King County. And he wants to bring new energy to the office. And I think that's commendable. I don't think Wynn has much chance. Constantine, of course, has the endorsement of every major Democrat and business group and all the rest of it. But it'll be interesting to see how Wynn does in this election. But it's N-G-U-Y-E-N. He's a Vietnamese immigrant. And, look him up on the ballot. I think he's worth supporting. The different King County Council positions, there's 9 positions that are up for election this time around. I think all of them, the incumbent is actually running for re-election. In position number 1, which is North Seattle, Ron Dombrowski is seeking a 3rd term. He's a fairly mainstream labor Democrat. He's done a reasonably good job. And most importantly, he's being opposed by somebody who doesn't seem to be running a campaign at all. A person named Sally Severzan, I think it's pronounced. She has no online presence at all that I can see. And has raised no money. And so, there really isn't much choice there. I would skip it or support Dombrowski. He's done a fine job. Position 3 is the one that's gotten the most attention this year. That's because incumbent Kathy Lambert, who is a Republican who has been in that position since the year 2000, Bear in mind, she was sworn in at the same time as the first term of George W. Bush. That's how long she's been in office. She has gotten herself in quite a bit of trouble this election season for sending out what a lot of people considered a very racist email blast that tried to conflate her opponent, who's a white woman named Sarah Perry. Perry, according to Lambert, is a socialist marionette, whatever that means. I think it's like a Marion Barry, only smaller. The socialists that she can compare them to were, of course, Shamus Awant and Jermé, for one of her colleagues from King County Council, who's the only person of color currently on King County Council, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But so she threw him in. She threw Kamala Harris in. And, of course, Harris and Sawant had absolutely nothing to do with county council. It was simply gratuitous and apparently put in there because of their skin color. And then, for good measure, Bernie Sanders was thrown in there also. And, of course, Sanders is Jewish. And there is a long anti-Semitic history of tropes of, you know, Jews and puppetry and, you know, all the rest of this kind of thing. And a lot of people pretty much took offense. All of our colleagues on King County Council, even the Republicans eventually, wound up condemning Lambert for these mailers. And, she lost a lot of endorsements and a lot of donations over this. And understand that this is the first time in her 20 years of running for reelection that Lambert has faced a serious challenge. Perry finished second in the primary, but she got 36% to Lambert's 40%. And the third place finisher was also a Democrat who got over 20%. So if you add those together, the Democratic vote in Lambert's district, which of course is demographically much different now than it was 20 years ago, was nearly 60%. So Lambert was already in trouble. And, that particular email blast, suggested that they had internal polling that that said they were in trouble. It smacked of trying to get the base energized and trying to get people scared, which is usually something people do when they are desperate or they don't have anything else to offer. Anyway, Perry is no socialist marionette. She's a moderate East Side Democrat, but she would be a vast improvement over Lambert, who has been an obstructionist force on county council for a couple of decades. So I would love to see Perry win that one. Let's see. So position number five is in South King County. This is kind of a tricky one. Dave Up the Grove is running for reelection against a woman named Shukri Olo, I believe is how she pronounces her last name. Olo is an immigrant, and as I say, certainly it would be nice to get more immigrants on county council to better reflect, you know, the population that they're serving. Upthick Grove was the first openly gay office holder outside the city of Seattle in the state of Washington. He's done a pretty serviceable job on county council since moving there from the state legislature. And, this would be his third term. And, you know, I think he's been solid. Olo looks solid as well. But Up the Grove has been a reasonably mainstream progressive Democrat for South King County. We'll see how that race turns out. And then the other one I wanted to talk about is position number nine, where Regan Dunn, who is one of the other Republicans on county council and who has a long history of not really doing anything on council except issuing press releases with stellar ideas like let's solve the homelessness problem by shipping them all somewhere else. You know, Dunn is an all-in Trump Republican, and he is running for re-election against Renton City Council person named Kim Khan Van, I believe is how she pronounces her name. She's been on City Council in Renton for a while. She was one of the two no votes when the Renton City Council voted last year to close the Red Lion that was being used as a homeless shelter during the pandemic. And she has a reasonably progressive record on City Council. I think she'll be fine on County Council. More to the point, as with Lambert, it's sort of addition by subtraction, right? You want to see more immigrants on council. You want to see people whose lived experience reflects the lived experience of people that they're representing. And that's simply not the case with Regan Dunn. He grew up as the son of longtime Republican Congresswoman Jennifer Dunn, who represented the East Side for many, many years up through the 90s before Dave Riker took that seat over. Most people don't remember Jennifer Dunn at this point, but she was not good. And Regan Dunn, ever since entering elected office, has carried with him that sense of sort of smug entitlement that I don't find becoming in an elected official. We'll talk about the sense of smug entitlement again when we get to the mayor's race. So that's county council. Port of Seattle, which hasn't gotten a lot of attention, but there are three positions up for election. And this is a countywide ballot, and it's notoriously difficult. The Port of Seattle, along with Seattle School District, is one of the historically most corrupt public agencies in the state. The commissioners don't get paid very much. They have a huge portfolio that they oversee. And this is true of the school board as well, which we'll talk about in a little while. But they're considered part-time employees, so they have to have full-time gigs to make a living. And those full-time gigs often they would apparently seem to have a conflict of interest with their positions at the port, put it that way. A lot of the candidates for port commissioner tend to be people from the marine industry or the cruise ship industry, or airline industry, people who have, you know, direct conflict of interest with operations at either the port or SeaTac Airport, which is the other agency that the Port of Seattle oversees. So that said, position number one, Ryan Calkins is up for re-election, and he is a genuine person who was elected 4 years ago as a reform candidate and has done exactly that. He's kind of a technocrat, sort of nerdy, but he's been very attentive to details and things like the budgets, trying to find solutions for expansion to SeaTac Airport while also making it more green, which is, doesn't seem like it's possible given the climate change, friendly nature of airline operations. But they are working on it, and, he has been working on it, and he deserves another term, I think. He's, running against somebody named Norman Sigler, who, aside from having a name that sounds like a character in a Hitchcock movie, it's not really clear. He says he's a corporate consultant, whatever that means. He has not run much of a campaign. He does appear to be friendly to the corporate interests that tend to dominate port proceedings, and that would make sense running against Calkins. You can sometimes tell how good a job an incumbent has done by the caliber of the opposition and the nature of the opposition that they get. So Ryan Calkins in position number one. Position number three, Stephanie Bowman is exactly part of the problem with the Port Commission. She's running for re-election, and she has been very friendly to the corporate interests that have dominated pork politics for forever, basically. She's being challenged by a guy named Hamdi Mohamed, who, again, would be better representation for the diversity that now is King County, that, you know, it wasn't 20 years ago, but it is now. And we need to slowly start seeing our office holders reflect that reality. Hamdi is, again, interested in the port equivalent of a Green New Deal, and, has been, solid on the campaign trail. And then, position number four, Peter Steinbrück is running for re-election. Now, Steinbrück, I honestly never understood why he ran for Port Commission in the first place. Other than that he was bored in retirement and needed something to do. For people who don't remember, he was on city council for over a decade. He ran for mayor a couple of times. And I consider Peter something of a personal friend, but I don't understand what he's doing on the Port Commission. He's been very much a voice for business as usual on that commission. And he's being challenged again by another immigrant voice, a woman named Toshiko Grace Hasegawa, who has been a labor organizer and a community activist in South King County for a number of years. She's very, very solid. She's interested in, both taking care of the people who would be impacted by an expansion of SeaTac, and also trying to see that that's done in an environmentally sustainable way. And I think she's very solid. Mm-hmm. So any questions so far before we get to the Seattle races?
No, I'm looking forward to this, especially to the analysis of Seattle races.
Well, we talked a little bit earlier about this week's debate for the Seattle mayoral race. Lorena Gonzalez, who's the current city council president, versus Bruce Harrell, who is the past Seattle city council president. And, you know, when Gonzalez came on to city council, which I believe was 6 years ago, she was considered an establishment figure. She was the personal attorney of Ed Murray, who was at the time the seeming mayor of Seattle for as long as he wanted to be. That was before we wound up finding out unfortunate details about Murray's past love life. In this race, she's being painted as some sort of wild-eyed radical, which she's not. She's very pragmatic. She's borne out that pragmatism in her years on city council. And she's led city council as its president, in a very even-handed manner over the past couple of years. And as I said, with the debate this past week, it's been true. And both Maria and I have commented on it a number of times over the past several months, all of these different forums and endorsement debates and presentations and town halls. Gonzalez has had very clear, very pragmatic plans for trying to tackle some of the more difficult and seemingly intractable problems in Seattle. And she would also be very much a change of pace from the current mayor in terms of her relationship with city council. Because, of course, Jenny Durkin has famously been at war with city council and refusing to basically pay attention to its funding priorities for most of her term. And that would not be the case with Gonzalez. She's much more collaborative, and I would expect to see a much more collaborative approach with city council. Were she in City Hall. Harrell, other than his ego, which is certainly a major factor, I'm really not sure why he's running. And obviously, he's got a path to the mayor's race, and he's got a lot of funding support from the business community and independent PACs and all the rest of that. that are trying to paint him as some sort of progressive Democrat. He has never been a progressive Democrat. He has his time on city council. He was autocratic. He was not responsive to constituents. He was consistently voted with business interests, and specifically with Amazon, for the head tax and all the rest of those controversies a few years back. And his priorities, as near as we can tell from the word salad that is his modus operandi when he does these public speaking events, his priorities haven't changed, and his personality certainly has not changed. And I think that we would get more of the same of that, certainly with the homelessness crisis, certainly with the affordable housing crisis, certainly with trying to get any kind of accountability or sense of reform with SPD, certainly with trying to increase density in Seattle by changing some of the single-family zoning ordinances. You know, none of that's likely to change. Harrell is business as usual at a point in the city's history where we have added 20% of our population is new in the last decade. And the city has done nothing to prepare for that population growth. We haven't invested in affordable housing. We haven't invested in infrastructure. There's all sorts of, different things that the city didn't do. They just decided that they wanted more population, and then they got very lucky because Amazon blew up and became, our new global overlords. I think it's a very clear choice. And it's not because Gonzalez is a wild-eyed progressive. I don't agree with her on some issues. I do agree with her on others. I appreciate the thoughtfulness that she brings to different issues, whether I agree with her on them or not. And I don't think that Harrell has that kind of thoughtfulness. I think he reflexively sides with the business community. And if the business community doesn't have a stake in it, he'll just go along with whatever it's been done for the way it was done when his daddy was around. And Seattle just isn't that city anymore. We're a big city now. We've got big city problems. We've got an enormous amount of wealth. We've got huge budgetary challenges and poverty challenges and housing challenges coming out of the pandemic. Of course, the pandemic is still going on, so we've got that public health crisis to manage as well. In many ways, the mayor's position is pretty thankless in terms of the kind of challenges that the mayor is going to be facing and the kind of pressures from all sides that the mayor gets just by the visibility of the position. And I think Gonzalez is much better equipped to handle that and to be responsive to those concerns from the community and to find solutions that may not please everybody, but they will at least actually be solutions as opposed to just playing, for instance, whack-a-mole with the city's homeless, which is not a solution at all.
You had previously mentioned about candidates having a lived experience with the people they are representing, and just looking at the donors to the two campaigns is interesting. From, let's say, for Bruce Harrell, who's got all the major real estate firms backing him, appears to have more in common with, let's say, his leading contributor to their PAC, John Goodman, who's donated on up to $90,000 so far to that PAC. And you compare that with Lorena Gonzalez, who has gotten her PAC has been primarily made up of unions, a couple of unions, which base their contributions on the different members.
That's actually democratically voted upon. And Harrell, don't forget, first got onto city council using his notoriety as a football star at UW. So he has been, I don't want to say pampered, but he's certainly had a sense of entitlement ever since he was, you know, in secondary school. Because if he was good enough to get a Division I football scholarship, you know, those kids are not usually held very accountable. And, you know, he's been entitled for most of his professional life. He went from, you know, his football career to law school to being an attorney and making bank with that and then on to city council. And now here he is running for mayor. And I just don't think that lived experience has a lot in common with, say, you or I, compared to Lorena Gonzalez, whose life story really is pretty compelling, being the kid of, you know, farm workers in Eastern Washington, working her way through school, all the rest of it. I think Gonzalez is a much more empathetic choice for mayor, if nothing else.
You also touched on Gonzalez having been attorney for Ed Murray at one point. I also wanted to note that she, of the people on council, she had been the first person to come out and ask or seek his resignation.
And that really was a nail in his coffin when she came out and did that. And it required, you know, not only some political courage, but also, you know, she has a personal relationship with him. So that was profiling courage. It showed leadership in a way that Harold never really has shown leadership. He's always stuck his finger in the wind to see which way Amazon is blowing before he makes a decision. So, I think Gonzalez would make a fine mayor.
All right.
So, now we get to the city attorney's race, and I cannot remember in my quarter century plus of following this stuff a more contentious or high profile city attorney's race. And that's because there was a three-way primary last summer, and the moderate middle of the race was the one who was edged out. That was incumbent Pete Holmes. He faced challengers both from the left and from the right, and somehow, inexplicably, both those challengers made it through the general election. On the right, let's talk about Ann Davison first.
Okay.
Because she is... how do I put this in a politic way? She's a disaster. She has run for three elected offices in the last 3 years. Two of those, including the city attorney's race this year, are nonpartisan. The other was last year when she ran for lieutenant governor as a Republican. So her only stated party affiliation is as a Republican. She says that she only joined the Republican Party. And mind you, that was in the middle of while Trump was being impeached for the first time. She only joined and exonerated by the entire Republican Senate. She was only running as a Republican because Seattle Democrats were not open to her ideas. And guess what? Those ideas haven't changed. And if you consider yourself a Democrat, which some 85% of the electorate in Seattle does, you still shouldn't be open to her ideas. She has not been a practicing attorney in several years. She has not seen the inside of a courtroom since Obama was president, which, actually was only about 5 years ago. It seems like a longer time than that, she has not been a practicing attorney for a number of years. And, she has, consistently made one of her, campaign mantras that, Seattle has too much violent crime. And when somebody points out, as they inevitably do, that the city attorney doesn't prosecute violent crime, felonies get prosecuted by the, King County attorney, who is Dan Setterberg. What the city attorney does is, very simple. It advises City Hall, the council, and the mayor's office on what might or might not be legal. It prosecutes misdemeanors and traffic infractions, and it makes decisions about those. And it decides on the legality of certain policies. And it defends the city against the lawsuits. That's it. There's nothing about violent crime in there. And when pressed on this, Davison will go, well, you know, if you prosecute misdemeanors, you get fewer felonies. That is the broken windows theory of law enforcement, popularized by Rudy Giuliani when he was New York City mayor a generation or so ago. And it has been conclusively disproven over the years. It doesn't work. And we've seen this where in cities similar to the size of Seattle, like San Francisco, Boston, Baltimore, where the cities have decided to prosecute fewer misdemeanors. They, you know, they popularize things like drug diversion programs, getting people mental health treatment, all those kind of diversionary programs, rather than getting people sucked into the criminal justice system. That it reduces recidivism. It reduces the crime rate. It even reduces the felony crime rate. And that is the exact polar opposite of what Davison is calling for. Davison first ran for office for city council 2 years ago. She made it to the general election against Garcia Juarez. It was the first and only time I'll probably ever endorse Juarez. And Davison was basically running a NIMBY campaign based on the, oh my God, aren't the homeless awful? Her solution for homelessness is basically very similar to Harold. It's make them all go away so that we don't have to see them. And that doesn't work because the homeless still have to be somewhere. And the only real long-term systemic way that you can address it is by creating more affordable housing, which is not something that Davison has remotely ever expressed an interest in. It's outside the purview of the race she's running for this time anyway. Her opponent this time is a woman named Nicole Thomas Kennedy, who comes out of the people of color-led abolitionist movement that fought the youth jail for King County in recent years. And she actually does have courtroom experience. And unlike Davison, she does seem to have a very clear plan for what she would do with the city attorney's office, which is to say she would vastly reduce the number of misdemeanors that she's interested in prosecuting. And she does have discretion over that. Now, there's been several knocks on Thomas Kennedy. One of them is her lack of experience, which is actually she's more experienced than Davison is. So check that one off. She has had some from prior to the time when she was a candidate, some intemperate marks about SPD, which, excuse me, haven't we all? And the whole, you know, she's a wild-eyed radical who wants to let, you know, the streets be crime-ridden and heroin needles line the sidewalks and all the rest of it. That's nonsense. If you listen to Thomas Kennedy, she's very measured. She's very clear about what does and doesn't work and has not worked in other cities and what she thinks would be appropriate at this point in our history for Seattle. Remember, we are not a small city anymore. We've got big city problems, and that includes poverty. It includes substance abuse use. It includes mental illness. It includes all sorts of things that, our Seattle Police Department, for all of its decade-long reform process, really is not a constructive presence in helping to solve. And that's really where she's coming from when she talks about abolitionism. Taking some of those public safety issues, not saying that they're not public safety issues, but saying that SPD is not the appropriate agency to be the first responder to those situations in most cases. I think she's got a much more cogent plan for what she would do with the office than Ann Davison does. I don't think that we need our misdemeanors prosecuted by somebody who joined the Republican Party during Donald Trump, and when the standard bearer for the Republican Party in the state of Washington was somebody who didn't concede, even though he didn't even get 40%, did not concede to Jay Inslee until earlier this year. You know, it's a totally Trumpian party in this at the state level as well as nationally. And that was the party she chose to join and seek the nomination of last year. Last year, you know, 1 year ago. But now she's moved on to her next opportunity. And if she doesn't win this race, I'm sure she'll run for something else next year. You know, I don't think we'll see, I've seen the last of her. But I do think that if she is elected to city attorney, she would be very dangerous, very reactionary, and not somebody we need in that position at all. Let's move on to Seattle City Council. The two at-large positions are up for election this year. One of them, Teresa Mosqueda, is running for re-election. She's running against a gentleman named Kenneth Wilson. Kenneth may or may not know what the frequency is. He's another one of these candidates who's raised no money and doesn't appear to be running an actual campaign. And Mosqueda has been a fine member of city council under her, I believe, 6 years on council. So that's an easy choice. Or you can skip it because she should win re-election easily. The more contested race is position number 9. In that race, we have Nikita Oliver, who narrowly missed out getting into the general election in her race for mayor 4 years ago. This time she's running for city council, and she's doing so as a much more experienced, much more seasoned community activist than she was 4 years ago. She has come into this campaign with very clear policy priorities for what she wants to do on city council. She is not a wild-eyed radical by any stretch of the imagination, and she represents a segment of the city that, you know, needs representation on city council. She is running against the business community's own Sarah Nelson, who, I'm sorry, I can't let go of this, but her city council experience was serving as a legislative aide to Richard Conlon, who was one of the single worst city council people in my memory before he was improbably voted off of city council in 2013 by Shama Sawant. And Sawant was able to win that race, even though she was explicitly socialist, specifically because so many people hated Conlon. And his office was so hostile to constituent input. Well, it was Nelson who was in charge of responding to that input. And for all of Conlon's arrogant smugness, you know, Nelson seems to have inherited a lot of that, mindset. She's got the solid support of the business community. She went on after her city council days to start Fremont Brewing, which is a fine brew pub. She should continue to operate a brew pub. She should not be on city council. And I think Oliver would be a fine city council person. I think she's shown in the last few years that she is, she's matured. She's better at collaborative processes, which are utterly essential if you're going to be effective on city council. So, that again, as with these other two high profile races, city attorney and mayor, a very stark choice between, the two different candidates. One heavily invested in and supported by the business community, the other heavily supported by labor and progressive nonprofits and activists. So with that excitement out of the way, we move on to Seattle School Board, which I can feel your eyes glazing over now, but we're almost done. There are three Seattle School Board positions up for re-election. And I have the same complaint with the Seattle School Board that I do with the Port of Seattle. They should, and for that matter, with the state legislature. These should not be part-time positions. They are. Seattle school board commissioners get a stipend of a few thousand dollars a year. That's it. And a part-time staff. And so what happens is you get people who are committed to reforming Seattle schools, which admittedly have been a hot mess for decades. Mm-hmm. And they get in there and they get led around the nose by the Seattle school district staff, because the senior staff have seen these commissioners come, seen them go, know they don't have time to research their own information on most issues. And so they just spoon feed them information as it suits their purposes. And it's that sort of permanent bureaucracy that is the real problem with the Seattle School District. We've seen any number of district superintendents come and go over the years, reform-minded board members come and go over the years. And so this year is no exception. But we will dive in anyway. Position number four, Vivian Song Moritz is seeking re-election over Lori Marie Rivera. And Moritz has been fine on the school board. I don't have a real strong take on that one way or the other, but I think Moritz has probably deserved re-election. Position number five, that's the real stark choice, because we've got Michelle Sarhu, not really sure how she pronounces her last name. But she's running against a guy named Don Harder, who wants to rid Seattle schools of critical race theory. Now, I am willing to bet that Mr. Harder never even knew the phrase critical race theory before he heard it on Fox News or somewhere in the right-wing fever swamp within the last year. I'm even more willing to bet that he doesn't actually know what critical race theory is. And I'm even more willing to bet that unless your 7-year-old is really, really precocious and is already in law school, they're not being taught critical race theory, because that's where critical race theory, the actual theory as opposed to the right wing boogeyman, is being taught. So Harder is pretty much disqualified off the face of it. So Michelle Sarhu is the clear choice there. And then finally, last but not least, and we're not quite done yet. We still have ballot measures to go, and they'll be quick. But position number seven on the Seattle School Board, Brandon Hersey is running for re-election. And he's running against somebody named Genesis Williamson, who I don't think was an original member of Bauhaus, but has no online presence, has not been running a campaign. So there really is no choice there except for Brandon Hersey, or you could skip it also. Okay. Now, we also have some ballot measures, and we're almost done. We have three advisory votes at the state level, and these are a result of the idiotic initiative that Tim Iman got passed about a decade ago that requires advisory votes any time the state legislature raises a tax or fee. Now, the legislature absolutely ignores these votes. I don't remember at any point in the last decade where they have not been maintained in the vote. The margins make absolutely no difference. But one of them might this year, because the whole purpose of Iman putting this on the ballot in the first place was to give Republicans talking points about, oh my God, they're raising your taxes. So let's look at these. Advisory vote number 36. That is a tax put on your telephone bill to create a new suicide prevention system. That seems like a worthy thing to me. Maintained. And you can vote maintained on any of these, or you can skip any of them because they're honestly meaningless. Except for 37, which is the capital gains tax that legislature finally, after a decade of struggle by Democrats, got passed last year. It puts a 7% capital gains tax on capital gains earnings, with some exemptions like sale of farmland, that sort of thing, over $250,000. So this is not a tax that's going to impact most of us. And primarily is targeted to people like Jeff Bezos Koff, who make most of their money by the value of stock holdings, not by actual, you know, punching a clock, for example, or earning a salary. So this raises some $10 billion for the state of Washington over the next, I believe that's annually. So it's a pretty significant assistance. The reason the state legislature finally passed it after years and years of it not getting out of committee was because the pandemic just put a smoking crater in the state's finances, and they needed a quick way to try and make up some of that budget deficit. I would vote maintained on this too, because it was a pretty common sense solution to a real need that the state has. Advisory vote number 38, is a 2% tax on something called captive insurers. Now you may ask, what is captive insurers? Is this something where I can take, a health insurance company executive and stick them in my basement dungeon and torture them to death? No, that's not what it is. tempting though that might be. Captive insurer is when, companies, do specialty insurance for things that aren't otherwise insurable, like microwave insuring its cloud, for example. Or Microsoft, I mean, insuring its cloud. That for a loophole in the state tax system that had not been taxed previously, so the state put a 2% tax on that, and I would recommend either, again, skip it or maintain on that one as well.
Okay.
Finally,
just about out of time.
Yeah, we're almost done. Really, we are. Okay. Two charter amendments, and they're both basically housekeeping. One and two. Number one corrects a grammatical error because insure, E-N-S-U-E, was misspelled insure with an I. So you can't change that in the county charter without having a vote. So vote yes, please. Come on. And then charter amendment number two is to align with the state law for the timeline required for initiatives, and that also is a yes. So that's it. And I will have those recommendations up on my Facebook site this weekend, and we'll probably go through all this all over again with Maria next week. So stay tuned for that.
Oh, all right. Or at least a lot of it.
Yep.
All right. Well, you packed a lot in there. With that, we are pretty much out of time. And
it's always like that with the ballot reviews. Yep.
It is. Trying to shoehorn a lot in.
Yep.
Very good. Well, look forward to talking with you again same time next week.
Yes, because, of course, the world still goes on. The pandemic still goes on. And, you know, we'll update on all those things and more next week.